Now the Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. And what we're doing today is reviewing bonding proposals to make a recommendation to the bonding committee. And the first bill we're going to look at today is Senate File 303, Senator Lori, and Senate File 1471, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Remembering with dignity is what Senate File 303 is. Again, it's a bonding proposal to help mark graves for those that lived at our state hospitals historically and did not get proper burial or proper markings when they passed away in the care of the state of Minnesota. So this is a matter of some concern and really passionate supporters that have been going around the state and trying to right this historic wrong. Senator Sieben and I have been working on this together, and I'll let her further describe it, and we have a few people that we'd like to help us make the point of what we're trying to accomplish.
Madam Chairman and members, just to add to that, since 1996, Minnesota has invested money in this effort to restore approximately 5,600 graves at cemeteries around the state of Minnesota. So what we're doing, what we're asking for today is additional money to continue that quest to provide basic human rights here to these people that died in our state institutions. And I know Senator Lori and I have both visited some of these places, and it is quite stark to see a number of grave sites where there may only be a number marking someone's life. So what this effort has done is provided proper recognition of these people's lives by providing headstones identifying who they were. So with us today to provide brief testimony is Hallie O'Falvey of St. Paul from Remembering with Dignity, and Larry Lubbers of West St. Paul, who's a member of Advocating Change Together.
Good afternoon. My name is Hallie O'Falvey, and I'm the community organizer for Remembering with Dignity. And we have made great progress in our goals to place names on unmarked graves at the state hospital cemeteries and use this renovation project to highlight the way people were mistreated in state institutions. As Senator Sieben said, in October of 2009, we had finished over 5,000 new grave markers, and these people were given their dignity. That's nearly half of the 13,000 that are in the state hospital cemeteries. Three monument companies worked with us last year, and we have great relationships with them, and they are shovel-ready. All I have to do is give them the verified number and names, and they're ready to go. Even in August of 2009, a social worker called me up from St. Peter, and there was a person who had died who was going to be buried without a grave marker. He had lived in St. Peter State Hospital. So there's still this happening today where people are being buried without graves with their grave markers with their names on it. So we'd like to continue the healing process and make sure that these inhumane treatments do not continue. Thank you. Yep, your turn.
Are there questions?
Not. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of quick questions. I'm just wondering if you know what the cost of the grave markers are as far as on an individual basis. Maybe we have something.
Yeah, they're approximately $250 a piece.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I'm also wondering how does that compare to how we we treat people in other kinds of circumstances, like people who are indigent and can't afford a grave marker, or people who are, I mean, I'm not sure exactly if there are comparable situations.
I think Larry could answer that for you.
I can answer that for you, because I used to live that life. I was in the institution, and I lived that life for a long time. And I just want to remember to have not a number, just a name on their grave. And something's going to have to be done, because it's still happening today.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, there's a couple of other factors, too. The 250 is not only for the headstones. This is requires the effort of a team of folks who go out, and they need to research extensively in the records to find out who these individuals are, because this is over the entire history of the state institutions across the state. So it's not simply a matter of buying a headstone for $250. This bonding keeps this community activity with significant volunteer hours. I don't know what percentage, but a lot of the work that's done is on a volunteer basis, and then the state is just a partner with a portion of the costs to help this investigative effort to identify who these individuals were, where they lived, and where they were buried, and go find, and that is a lot of work. And then they, at the end, go and place marker, and they were in my neighboring community of Moose Lake earlier this summer, and had the final ceremony where they had identified the very last of the individuals buried there. And it's a really powerful community building spirit behind this, and I don't know exactly whether it's apples to apples if you start looking at what we do for indigent clients.
Well, and this was started by the ACT members. It was a project that they decided that was really important, and they worked really hard. They started to develop it in 1994, and then in 1996 was the first time that the state appropriated money for it.
And Senator Olson, indigent people have their burial costs covered by the county. And I don't know how much is made available, but I know it's way more than $250. Other questions?
Did you have more to say? I think Larry had one or two
okay.
more points,
I got two
Madam
more
Chair.
Questions. We went down there in the summertime, and it was Jim and me, and we had a hard time finding them numbers, but they were there. Mm-hmm. And we went down the hill, and as soon as we got back to ACT, we figured there got to be something done. There got to be something done now, not next year right away.
Thank you.
What Larry is talking about is Hastings State Hospital. The numbered grave markers were in cylinders, and they would raise up, and the groundskeepers threw them over the sand coulee, just threw them over the hill. So someone had been out there investigating that, and then Larry, with quite a few other people, went down and picked him up and carried him back to the office.
Senator Bergman, or
Senator
Madam
Corey.
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Laurie, I'm sure that this is, you already know the answer to this. Is this bondable? I'm assuming it is.
It is. We've bonded for it in the past.
Okay.
This is all on state property. It is state operations and how we've conducted ourselves historically.
And then, Madam Chair, so looking at these markers with the numbers, you know, is there a record of who the person was, and so then we would put their name on a marker then and do
right.
it with dignity then?
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Coring, that's right, and that's what I was describing to Senator Olson, too, is that there is some records work, historical work, to find out who these individuals were. I mean, this is a long history in our state institutions. 13,000 individuals died and were buried at our institutions without proper markings. And so this is going back and find the historical work to find out who they are, where they are, and give them their proper due and put the gravestones out and have a ceremony and recognize their life with dignity.
And Madam Chair, I would just say I'm sure I'm going to be critical of a lot of bonding projects, that I think are unnecessary, but I will say that this is going to be one that I'm going to be very supportive because I think a society is judged on how we treat our people. And I still believe that we're very generous in this state as far as benefits are concerned, and I'll go to my grave with that, but not meaning anything by that, and just a poor choice of words. But I will just say that treating people with dignity in doing this project, I think, is very good, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator Coring.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
All
for coming in.
Thank you.
The next one on the agenda is Senate File 1536. This is the Moose Lake Sex Offender Project.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senator Coring, we'll give you one more try here at being generous. We've got a project for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake. We bonded phase one a few years ago, which was the first half of the beds, but then even with phase one funding in place, we recognized that it was not going to be a complete facility. We needed to do the design work for phase two out of phase one funding as per the plans put in place at the time. Phase two would include another 450 beds and the operations and program space, little things that help run a program like a kitchen that were not included in phase one. Phase one is essentially just additional beds. And we have somewhere in the mid-500s, about 550 clients right now at the Moose Lake facility. We had the original facility designed for 100 clients and a new phase one accommodated about another 450 more. So we're approaching capacity, and we're still sending between 60 and 70 clients a year out of our corrections facilities into our sex offender program, and we don't have the tools in place right now to stem that growth anytime soon, and so we are in dire need to go ahead and build that additional bed space while we still work on some more creative solutions and try to work on things. This will, you know, I know this program draws a lot of attention for the high per diems, which reached 387 back in FY07. They've come down a little bit since then, but one of the things that we've found has driven our costs is that we've not had one consolidated facility in order to do the treatment for this very high-need population. And with a full facility, other states, and Minnesota is projected to be able to get that per diem down from the high of $387 down to $250 a day per diem if we're able to make these investments in infrastructure on the front end. And so the governor's bonding proposal is not out as of today. It is due on Friday, and I remain hopeful. I've been in contact with his office a little bit and encouraged him to consider this greatly. We won't know again until Friday, but some of the folks from his agency are here to help describe what would happen if this project were to move forward. And so with me are Dennis Benson, the executive director, and Dan Storkamp, the deputy director of the program, to help describe more about what it would look like if we were to do phase two.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the executive director of the program. We've got a very short PowerPoint. We're going to walk through it. Many of you toured the facility, and we gave a very similar presentation. So some of this might be repetitious. As Senator Laurie indicated, we continue to be a growing entity. We are growing to the tune of about the average of 66 a year. You'll see that in a moment or two. The thing about this program or this project is it is shovel ready. It is a big project. The price tag that the initial estimate was about $96 million to complete the project. That gives us both infrastructure that is lacking and an additional 400-bed unit. Really, it's population that drives the size of the proposal. We don't determine who comes in. As we all know, that is a court-driven process. And as Senator Lori indicated, we did bond 400 beds back in, I believe, 2006, but none of the infrastructure, the corresponding treatment space, kitchen space, dining space, office space, was included. So we are hurting in those areas, as many of you saw when we toured the facility. Next slide is the population growth. This is both retrospectively and prospective in terms of what projections are. They are down a bit from last year. If you want more detail, I'd defer to Dan Storkamp. But the average, again, if you look at the pink barred area, is still about 66 a year, down from over 70 a year when we did last year's projections. As Senator Lori said, I think that there are some other positive indicators with respect to the growth curve, but these are the projections as we know them today, based on current practice for the most part and policy. This next slide is really where we're at in terms of bed space. The base or the black was the phase one and the units down at St. Peter. The white bar in the middle, or three of them there, were the annex beds from the prison that we rented for several years when MSOP simply ran out of space. Phase one is the yellow. That's the building that we opened this summer. And if we can draw a line there right at the end of 2012, we will be full again. So this is a project that needs critical consideration just based on the notion of where are we going to put them if we don't bond this project. As we sit here today, phase one is about half full. It was half full actually the day that it opened this summer. So as we got those clients out of the annex from the prison, we started to fill that up pretty quickly. This next slide just indicates what has gone on with both the growth and MSOP positions. We have been able to create some efficiencies with the phase one building and some other internal initiatives that we've put in place. We've eliminated, through attrition, about 212 positions minimally. That results in about a $10 million annual savings. So that's the good news, I guess. I guess the challenging news is the fact that the program continues to grow. And again, that is a court-driven process. If they're civilly committed, we have to take them. We not only house them, but we are required constitutionally and by statute to treat them. And that it's a very staff-intensive program, unlike my previous life in corrections, where we could make the decision to choose X percent of our sex offenders. I think in corrections we actually treated about 17%. Today we're treating close to 90% of the clients that come into the MSOP facilities. The next slide here just indicates what has happened with our budget. And I just remind you that we've been able to cut this budget by pretty close to a little over $10 million as this population continues to increase. If that trajectory would have continued in fiscal year 08, our current annual budget would be somewhere around $100 million. So again, we are trying to be mindful of costs and at the same time offering meaningful treatment that is grounded in not only best practices, but also hopefully ultimately some results as the treatment protocol continues to evolve. And then again, this next slide just summarizes, as Senator Lori indicated, back in 07, we were at a $387 a day per diem. Actually, in 2000 or in 08, 09, if we would have added the $16 million deficiency request, we would have been well over $400 a day. And today we're at $328. So in a three-year period, we've brought it down pretty close, well, about $50 a day, $49 a day. Every bed that we're adding, the marginal cost is only $150 a day. So as the population grows, it's really a cost avoidance calculation. Our budget is not going to get any lower, but it's going to grow at a much slower rate based on that marginal per diem. If you look at the bottom part of this slide, we sort of fit in about the middle, I guess maybe a little bit higher than that at this point in time. But again, if phase two is bonded, we can continue to expand at just two physical plants. We are confident that we can get that per diem down to around $250 a day in today's dollars. Next slide is just a summary of what goes into the per diem. I'd also ask that the top slide to the right, the $303 a day, is the operational per diem. The bottom total, $328, is fully loaded with statewide indirect, DHS indirect costs, building depreciation, bond interest. Many of those costs we don't believe are included in the previous slide where we're compared to other states. And then finally, this is an aerial view of our site up at Moose Lake. The main building was built back in 1995. Phase one, or complex one, actually was the one that was built or opened this past July. And then you can see to the middle left where we intend to place phase two building and the corresponding infrastructure if this bonding proposal is recommended by the governor and accepted by the legislature. And then this gives you kind of a layout of what it will look like completed, the two 400-bed star buildings and all of the infrastructure area. Those are all of the things that are lacking right now as we try to accommodate and manage this growth. We have, I think, around 10, 11 treatment rooms today. When we're full, we think we need about 55 treatment rooms. Food service, we are literally going to be setting up a temporary kitchen in a recreation area to provide food service. Health services is lacking. We need a mental health facility inside of this facility. As you can probably imagine, we have lots of folks that have mental health issues, laundry, canteen, property, education, security, and then vocational work is a large part of the treatment protocol as well that we have to expand to correspond with the expanding population. Warehouse, loading dock, those of you that toured saw that we have turned our loading dock into a freezer area right now. So much of this is very challenging on a day-to-day operational issue, but it also inherent in trying to manage all of these support services are some security issues and even some public safety issues because we aren't able to offload and unload patients that have to go to hospitals and court and on and on and on. And then this next slide just simply indicates what the facility was originally designed for, where we're at today. And today we're actually at about 350 clients up north, about 170, I believe, at St. Peter. And then there's about 65, 66 that are dually committed that are currently housed in the Department of Corrections. And then the far right column is kind of a summary of what we think we will. Actually, we know we will need this much space if we have the 950 clients up there eventually, which projections show, even if projections slow, there's going to be growth in this area of our system. And we have to have a plan that is a little bit better thought out than the plan that we had a few years ago when we had beds and corrections. Yeah, we had lots of significant issues with that arrangement, and it was very, very expensive for the taxpayers. Again, treatment rooms, main building was designed for 100 clients, currently serving 150. We have five treatment group rooms. Complex 1 currently serves 250. We have one treatment room and group room. We're short by about 15. We have temporary treatment rooms and group rooms. Again, those of you that toured understood very visually what our challenges are with respect to trying to provide the treatment for this population under current conditions. So again, there's not much that has changed here from our presentation, I believe, in August. We would hope that you would certainly give this project some consideration moving forward. And if you have any questions, we're available to respond.
Do you know by any chance what your request, if any, is for an increase in the second year of the biennium for your operations?
Our this, Madam Chair, this biennium, the current biennium, I believe we're at about 2.4 in growth. Is that correct?
It's about 67.4 or 5 million total, and we're at 64.8 today. So it is about 2.8.
Yeah, 2.8.
So there'll be a request for 2.8 more than you were given.
Madam Chair, that's in our current budget.
Well, that's in your current budget.
Right. Mm-hmm. We will not be asking for a change item with respect to operational costs.
That's about the best news I've heard all day. other questions, Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Mr. Benson, just a couple of questions to lead up to my main question. Does the federal government have requirements as far as buildings and how we, the facilities that we have for this population? And is the federal government participating in paying for some of the costs that we have on this program, or are we paying it for at the state level?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, this is a state-driven program.
Okay.
The courts really drive many of the standards. We have licensing standards that we have to comply with. there are certainly maybe some federal case law that drives our decision-making in terms of what we have to include in that treatment protocol every day. For the most part, there are 20 states that have civilly committed sex offender treatment programs. And the federal government has began their own program that they operate, I believe, in one of the Carolinas. There was a court case that was heard yesterday at the Supreme Court level that is going to be pivotal for them. But with respect to our program, it has been challenged twice, I believe, at the state Supreme Court level, and the laws have been upheld. That has occurred over the course of the past 14, 15 years since the law went into effect.
And, Madam Chair, that kind of leads me into what, you know, I don't understand, you know, Mr. Benson, this is a ginormous bonding request. This is, even if we do a $900 million bonding bill, I mean, this is 10% of the bonding bill. And why, when I, in my district, at the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center site, there's 22 buildings that are sitting there virtually empty. The state has facilities. And I just maybe I'm getting ornery in my old age, but I just cannot understand why state government is just, let's just build it new. And I don't understand why it costs $250 a day. I mean, I'll never understand that. You know, I'm not as smart as everybody here, but it just, I cannot understand that. And I cannot understand why, when we have buildings already, why can't we just fix those up and put these people in there? I don't know. I mean, we just have got to start thinking out of the box. You don't have to answer any of that. I'm just going off on all this.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, I appreciate your interest and frustration with this issue. Remember, I came from a system where we had the per diem down to $75 a day in corrections, and we were getting criticized because that was too high. So I had sticker shock when I came over here, too, and started to work on an almost $400 a day per diem with this population. But this is a very, very different situation. It's apples and oranges from corrections. We have to treat these people. If we don't, it's going to be found unconstitutional. The courts are watching this program very, very closely. They're taking a keen interest in this notion that we lock people up civilly based on what we think they might do in the future. That is a constitutional standard that really sort of flies in the face of most of our Constitution, both at state and federal level. So we have to be very, very careful how we manage and run this program. And if we don't manage it in accordance with prescribed statute, law, case law, and rules, we could have a real public safety dilemma in this state if the courts step in. And they have in some states. Courts have stepped in and taken these programs over. And then you're dealing with astronomical costs. I would also submit that going to a third location, we have two locations now, but going to a third location would drive that price sky high, because you're going to have another director, you're going to have another maintenance crew, you're going to have all of those infrastructure costs that are going to be duplicated again. That's what happened when we went over to corrections. We had to duplicate many of those costs. The 210 staff that we have taken off the payroll has been due in large part to the fact that we went from three sites to two. So economy of scale and expanding at existing physical plants is a very efficient way to do this. Of course, we could go to a different site. When I was in corrections, there was a move afoot to build a new facility as opposed to build on at Faribault, or go to another old regional treatment center. But we learned a hard lesson from that experience. The buildings are old. They're not geared for this kind of clientele. Dealing those with mental health and mental illness issues is very different from this population. Again, it's apples and oranges. These people present security challenges that MIs and MINDs don't. And you will pay in bonding costs 50 times over in operational costs if you add another site to a program that is still only 560 beds.
I think I figured it out. I really did. If judges want to be legislators, then every time they say that we have to do with this program or we have to do with this program, we'll just take it out of the judiciary's budget to cover the cost of that.
Oh. Well,
wouldn't that be a great idea? I guess not. Everybody isn't.
I'm not
I think
sure
it's a
that
great
we
idea.
Get everybody on that committee to agree with
no,
us.
Well, I think it's a great idea.
But I would certainly agree with you that I think our judiciary's been a little overzealous in this area in the past. Nobody wants to be caught with the case that caused a problem. So, you know, when we went from 8 to 80, somewhere in the middle there has got to be more of a right number in my opinion. Other questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Chair Berglund. Mr. Benson, first of all, I'd like to compliment you on your efforts to drive down the cost and your past efforts in the criminal justice system, too. And that's very much appreciated. Having said that, there are many states whose costs for treating this population are significantly lower than ours are, and they treat them differently than we treat them. And I think there is great will on the part of some legislators to change law so that they would be handled differently. And if that change were ever to occur, then after we've put $90 million into a new facility, would we be able to convert that to some other type of facility or some different use?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, I believe there are other options. It is located less than a half a mile from the Moose Lake State Correctional Facility. It's on, actually on the same parcel of land, so there may be some opportunity there. That is, again, another old Department of Human Services campus that's in very ill repair. What we should have done when I was wearing my Deputy Commissioner of Corrections hat is turned all of those facilities that we got free from DHS into a rock pile and built K buildings or star buildings like the ones that we have built for this population. We helped DHS design this building type. It's very similar to what we built in corrections down at Faribault. We have four of the buildings down there. We have one at Lionel Lakes. It is a it's designed in such a way that it minimizes the number of security staff that we need. Sight lines are well-defined, and they are efficient buildings. So I think somewhere in the future, if the population did go the other way, there would be an opportunity to make some other uses of that facility. I can tell you that I think the other thing I need to remind us all of is that we don't decide how many we get every year. That is a court-driven decision. We also don't decide how many go out each year. That's also a court-driven decision. I can tell you that I think that the treatment that we're providing is starting to show some results, very slow results, but as we sit here today at the end stage of treatment down at St. Peter, we now have four individuals, with number five had a positive recommendation here a couple weeks ago that I believe there is a time frame that the county can challenge that placement, and the commissioner has to review it, but soon to probably be five in our community preparation service program, whether he comes or somebody else comes, and that's up from 1 2 years ago, so or 0 2 years ago. So that's kind of the last step before somebody, at least theoretically, would be considered for provisional discharge, and again, that's a court call. But I see some things impacting on this growth curve. But I think the growth is still going to be there. That's my point. And, you know, the issue always is, well, can we build just one unit or two units, or can we piecemeal this thing? And I suppose there's a way to do that, but that drives up costs. It drives up security issues. It, I think, further jeopardizes public safety because now you're trying to build inside of a secure perimeter. There are challenges with that. So we have tried to be thoughtful about how we approach this project in terms of getting it done. And again, as we sit here today, we don't know what the governor is going to put in his bill. That is a consideration that we all have to be mindful of, but we should know in a couple of days if all part or any of this project is going to be included. I can tell you from an operational perspective, there are glaring needs, particularly, and it's, you know, it's what do we need worse, the infrastructure or the beds? It's really a Sophie's choice. I mean, we need them both very badly. If we don't start to get some treatment space, I'm concerned about, again, the challenges that will come from clients in terms of their ability to access appropriate treatment. So that's a long answer, but the short answer is I believe that there will be other uses, and I also believe, unfortunately, that this population is going to continue to grow. I think what we can hope for is slowing that growth.
Mr. Benson, I'm wondering if you have ever quantified what the per diem for just the beds that you rented from corrections was.
We can, Madam Chair, we can certainly get that number. But we...
I mean, as I see the alternative, that's the only alternative. And, you know, I have concern that drives up our budget. And for quite a few years now that I can remember we've been cutting other things to fund this program. So if there's, and I might just say that we've known that this was on the docket for some time. I recommended to the bonding committee that they start this project last year. That would have taken 35 of the 90 off the table this year. And wasn't able to persuade people to do that. But it isn't like we haven't known that this was something we were going to have to do one of these days. And the alternative, I fear, is renting beds from corrections again. And I know that that was a very expensive proposition. I just don't know how expensive it was.
Madam Chair, we can get you that information, but we're literally paying for them twice because corrections is full, as we all know. It's essentially full. And now the safety valve or the relief valve for corrections is going away. They were renting beds out at the privately held facility in Appleton, and they are going to close that facility, I understand, the end of February. So that is no longer available. So this notion that they could move a couple hundred out and we could rent from them again, I don't think that option is even available anymore. So we are in even a tighter spot than we were 4 or 5 years ago when we were renting the annex beds. So I think our options...
Well, and I can say this. I don't know if you can say this, but I can say that we were a good customer for corrections. You know, they were not giving us any discounts.
Having negotiated that contract, Madam Chair, you're right.
So I'm glad we've got you on our side of the table now. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've just been, and I appreciate we had a little conversation even before the meeting today. Because this is such a growing project problem for our budget, and because there are constitutional aspects, legal aspects of this that I think are important if we want to uphold the principles in our Constitution, I don't think we can just disregard those things. But I share some of Senator Corrine's concerns about the if this isn't a sustainable system, what is, and what Senator Prettner-Solon said too, what are the ultimate answers to it going to be? And do we need to take a couple steps back and figure those things out before we talk about how we're going to spend this amount of money? I was just at a couple of county board meetings in my district, and I was asked by the county board members, why do we have beds sitting empty in our jails that we can't fill? But we're talking at the state level about building more beds. And, of course, there's a difference between incarceration versus treatment. But we still have the same population and these beds. And the reason we are having to treat them differently is because they were sentenced for a determinate sentence, and now we still feel they're a danger to society because they have a mental condition that causes them to be dangerous. So I asked Senator Berglund, well, if it's a mental condition, why isn't the federal government paying for it? And she explained the rule for me about that that has to do with the federal government. But if we have parity in mental health, then it would seem to me that that this ought to be more like a federal government financial responsibility. But on the other hand, if we're looking at it more as a crime, then we really ought to be looking at our sentencing. When I was in the Air Force and was involved in these kinds of cases, we didn't have determinate sentencing. We had indeterminate. Well, I take that back. We had indeterminate potential sentencing, and so a lot of focus went into looking at the individual criminal at the time of sentencing, determining if we thought they were a pedophile that wasn't likely to be, had a low probability of successfully treating that person, as opposed to a situational offender, and making those hard calls at the front end, where from a constitutional standpoint, they probably belong. And or maybe, you know, there's going to be indeterminate sentencing, not just a range of sentences at the front end, but revisiting this at a later point and treating them and dealing with them within the criminal justice system. So why aren't we having that discussion? And I guess that's my question.
Go ahead. You can take it.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, there have been some enhancements of CRIMSEC statute in recent years, but unfortunately, there's a lag in when we'll see the results of that because sentences were very long, 10, 15 years. So we won't see the results of that longer sentencing policy for 10 or 15 years. Can also say that some of those enhanced sentencing options are not always being utilized by the courts. They might, in some cases they are. I think when we were in corrections, there were 5 to 10 of those. But I think the other issue that I'd like Mr. Storkamp to touch on just a moment is the issue of population trends and projections. We got some very interesting information here from sentencing guidelines, and the number of sex offenders that are being convicted of felonies has really kind of flatlined at about 580, I believe.
Correct.
So, Dan, if you could ask him to.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, to address your issue, the projections that we've seen this year actually are showing improvement over last year by a decrease of, as we talked about 10 per year. A lot of that has to do with what we're seeing from the Department of Corrections. Those on the criminal justice committees have seen that the numbers have gone down slightly. Guidelines overall for felonies have gone down 5% this year, 4.7%. That was down from 1.2% the year before. When we look at sex offenders, though, specifically, as Executive Director Benson talks about here, they're pretty much flat. But what's nice is they actually have gone down a little bit from previous years in the past. There's just a lag time of the system catching up. The other piece that we've looked at real closely and have impacted our projections is the impact on referrals to the courts or those being released from the Department of Corrections. The releases are actually down slightly, so we've readjusted our projections based on those going down, and the referrals going out have actually gone down slightly as well. And we will monitor that as the next couple of years go forward. But we're hopeful, as you are, that that number continues to go down, and as Senator Berglund says, the system adjusts to a happy medium on what we need to do for addressing this population.
But I think maybe what you might have missed, Senator Olson, in the response is that the Crime Prevention Committee worked on this issue a number of years ago when Jane Ranum was chair of that committee, and passed legislation for indeterminate sentencing of sex offenders. And the result has been few convictions under the law. And, you know, one can speculate as to why that would be, but I believe in part it is because the courts have to treat that as if it were a life sentence. It wasn't the intention of the law. The intention of the law was to make assessments as people were, as the years went by, and to try to determine if someone was a level three to keep them, and if they weren't, to release them. But at the time of the trial, the judiciary system has to treat it like a life sentence. And as a result, oftentimes the cases are negotiated to a lesser charge because of the cost and the stakes of using an indeterminate sentencing system. So it didn't provide very much of a solution. It's kind of what happened here.
Madam Chair and members, the other thing that we are doing jointly with corrections is we are pre-treating over in corrections people that are probably headed for civil commitment. We've got a new clinical director over there. We've got an annual report that will be coming out and giving you some data around not only that program but our program as a whole. But we hold out some hope that as we treat these people in corrections, a couple of things might happen. We may be able to divert some of them from civil commitment because it is a program that's kind of geared around those that are headed for civil commitment. Or if they are ultimately civilly committed, they may not need to be with us for five, six, seven, 8 years. In fact, we got one of those individuals this past year, and he immediately went to St. Peter, which is kind of the end stage of treatment. So we're seeing some small successes with that initiative as well. That, I think the other important thing to understand is after the 2003 tragedy, we went out and looked at every level three and started to sweep some of those folks up and bring them into the civil commitment program. As some of those level threes violated the conditions of their release under corrections, as they were reassessed, many of those came into the program. So there was a huge growth spike, and I honestly do think this number will come down some, but to believe that it's going to come down to no growth, I think is unrealistic, at least in the foreseeable future. I think we can certainly bring the daily cost down as we continue to grow because of the economy of scale issue. There's going to be costs, there's going to be growth costs, but it isn't going to be as exorbitant. And the other thing, hopefully someday the courts will deem some of these people to the point where we might even provisionally discharge a couple. That's, I think, another possibility that will help. This population is also aging. I remind people that since I've been here almost two years now, I think we've lost about eight or nine to death. So some of them that refuse to participate in treatment are probably going to die in the facility too. So that's
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Benson, you've done a nice job of laying out for us what the capacity issues are. But, I think the bottom line here is, and what I'm hearing is that, like so many other areas, pick your area, whether it's K-12 or other areas of health and human services and on down the line, we can't afford to continue doing business as we've been doing business. And I frankly feel like we are skirting around the issue here. And while the discussion today is on this bonding proposal, we have missed the boat. Because what we in fact really need is a very serious policy discussion on this issue. And that policy discussion should happen on the forefront so that we can respond to the policy discussion with our infrastructure. And so I'm very cognizant, Senator Lori, of the dynamics that are in place. I get that, but I think it's important for the record to reflect that we have a policy discussion that we are grossly in arrears on in this state.
Other questions? Okay, well, we thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Let's move on then. The next item on the agenda is Senator Clark, Senate File 398, which is for bonding for early childhood facilities. I would just remind the members that we are going to be ranking these proposals for Senator Lanxess consideration when we finish the hearing today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We have a couple people here from Greater Minnesota. I'm going to make my opening comments fairly brief, in part because Ms. Harris needs to getting back to St. James. So we have three people here to testify. I know that many, if not all of you, well know this particular proposal and how important it is statewide. So we have the early childhood facility bonding proposal in front of you. As you know, it is different than most of our bonding proposal in that it is operated more like a grant program. And the committee has certainly been wonderful about this, understanding the need to be preparing our youngest learners for the future. So the grant program is for building or rehabbing facilities for early childhood intervention programs. We did have some money last year in the bonding bill that was vetoed, but I think the governor wanted to make sure that the size of the bill was pretty small, and this is a different day, and this is an important project as we're moving forward. As you probably recall, Tom Stinson, our state economist, spends a fair amount of time talking about human capital development and thinking about our workforce development. And I know that there's a number of corporations in our state that talk about our workforce being strong right now in terms of preparedness, but being afraid about what's going to happen in the next 10 to 12 years. So making sure, as we have an aging demographics, that every small child is going to be ready to be productive and working on reducing the achievement gap. And clearly making sure we have facilities that meet those needs is important. So the funding comes from bonds. So typically it's awarded to a school district or a city or a county. But there are many private entities through Child Care and Head Start that are involved. It builds on partnerships and collaboration. And that is one of the pieces that is a priority. The more projects that are involved, more programs, the higher ranking it is. Priority is also given to areas of the state with the highest percentage of children living in poverty, the children who are going to benefit the most from quality early care and education. You may recall that it is a form of matching grants, but the local communities, generally speaking, unless it's rehab, put in far greater than 50% because the maximum you can get out of this pot is $750,000, but that acts as leveraging on that local basis. So the other piece that I think is important for you to know is that we do have a number of projects around the state that communities are hoping to get started on, and there are not the resources right now. And so with me today, we've got a couple of great people who have been working specifically on a local level, first Sue Harris and then Steve Nagel. And then Jerry Cutts with First Children's Finance will speak a little bit about how these projects get put together. The last thing I want to say before Ms. Harris goes, because I know she needs to get leaving, is that when we're thinking about the economy and the workforce, one of the factoids, even though I've worked on early childhood for a long time, that I didn't realize is that the early care and education workforce has more gross receipts of well over $900 million, second only to corn and hotel industry in Minnesota. So remember that the revenues that go into these jobs end up also helping more broadly our communities and our families. Madam Chair, if it's okay if Ms. Harris goes first, that would be helpful. Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak to something that is very near and dear to my heart and something that I think is critical for our state. First, I want to tell you a little bit about who I am and where I come from. I am the Community Education Director for St. James Public Schools, and I'm from St. James, which is a very small rural community in Watonwan County. Our school district population is 6,000. Our town is a little over 4,000, so we're very small and rural. Interesting notes about our community is that we're reaching over 50% Hispanic population in our town. Our leading industry is food processing and agriculture. And we have had the highest per capita teen pregnancy rate in the community. So for small rural communities, we have some situations much like the metro area, and yet we struggle to deal with that with small rural communities. And so the handout that I have before you is some of the issues that we're dealing with as we deal with children. The other point of note that's really interesting is my husband is in corrections, and I'm in early childhood. And so I'm hoping to prevent so I couldn't think of anything better to follow corrections than early childhood, because if we do a good job, hopefully we can minimize some of those negative outcomes. In small rural communities particularly is that we have an aging buildings within our school district and lack of appropriate space for children. In small rural communities, your major resource is your public school. In our particular community, we've had 6 failed bonds. And our buildings, our newest buildings were built in 1960. Our oldest buildings are 1929. And so as we try to pull together to provide appropriate childcare space for our children, our public schools are the place that is delivered. Then if I would like to have you envision a 6th grade classroom and wonder how that might be appropriate for infants and toddlers, knowing that I can't send the children down the hall to go to the bathroom by themselves, I need to have someone go with them. I also need to have a couple different sinks because I can't do food preparation at the same place where I change diapers. I also can't put them. We have lots of room on our old buildings upstairs. But the fire marshal says that I need to be able to take all of those kids out in a crib immediately out. I can't take them one at a time in case of a fire. And we did actually have a fire in our old 1929 building. So there's things that we need for our little children and the inability to try to do that. Our district has collaborated together where we work with teen pregnancy, family literacy, early childhood family ed, and a large percent of what we do is child care. 2 years ago, our leading industry was looking at wanting to have some expansion and worked with our EDA director as what is the ability of our community to deliver this child care. We can't grow in our current facility space. We've struggled and struggled. I have 20 families in my small community that are on my waiting list. And so we've struggled, and the failed bonds have always included these early childhood spaces. So we are looking creatively on how we can restructure this. And so we are working with an architect, and we're looking at revamping old space or adding on, and we're at the point of trying to figure out how to do this. The touch point is, and our district has committed, you know, almost $800,000, just a little bit under that, to do this. But their decision to go forward will come this spring, depending on the funding that our school districts have, because some of these dollars are health and safety dollars, and some of them are general fund. And that knowing how fully funded we are and how we're going to be able to meet the financial needs in our district. Currently, we're going from 4 administrators, and that we're looking at going down to 2. And we're consolidating our buildings to try to create our infrastructure as lean and mean as we can to try to least affect our educational dollars. But we are committed as a community to our earliest children. How do we do this? And so knowing that our economy is depressed, knowing that our construction business also in our area is depressed, having these dollars will help at that level as well as an economic development level, because this has been our EDA's, one of their top strategies, is we need to have the child care spots for people to even be able to go to work correctly. And we want the programs to be as quality, but along with that, the facility has to be right for our littlest ones with, as you know, Health and Human Services regulates our child care industry. And, you know, there are certain things that we need to have to appropriately care for our littlest ones. So I would ask that you would carefully and consider this. Having these dollars available to us may mean the ability for our community to move forward, to look at how we can use what we have to the best way possible and on behalf of our youngest children. So thank you. And thank you for your time and consideration on this. Questions?
Madam Chair, which one is Mr. Cutts? I like your name. we're going to need some cutters around here. Right?
Thinking about changing it to leverage.
Amen.
All right.
So who would like to go next?
Mr. Nagel.
Steve Nagel. I've got some pictures of the facility that I'll pass around.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Steve Nagel. I'm the executive director of West Central Minnesota Community Action, which is located in Elbow Lake. And over the years, I've been involved with 4 bonding projects in Perham, Parker's Prairie, Monaga, and the last one, which was in Browns Valley. And what I want to say about these is all 4 of these projects were in towns of less than 1,000 people. 2 of these were renovations, and 2 of them were new buildings. But in all 4 communities, the Head Start program was threatened because they could not find space that they could get licensed for the early childhood projects. The particular project in Browns Valley, which has the pictures, the facility they were renting really had sporadic water and furnace, and it had a rodent problem. And the program was going to have to leave the area if we didn't succeed with this project. The bonding program gave $100,000, and we raised $80,000 locally, including a $30,000 from the Sisseton-Wahpeton Band in South Dakota. It was the first time they had funded something off the reservation and the first time they had funded something in the state of Minnesota. So it was just really a very, very, very big deal. The facility is shared. The The Browns Valley Food Shelf is located in there. Traverse County Social Services and Public Health have their offices in the building as well. I want to note that Traverse County is the smallest county in population in the state and also the oldest county. The average age is the oldest in Traverse County. It's a difficult place, and this project would not have happened any other way. But in addition to the folks that are housed there, it's also used by social services, legal services, and rural Minnesota SEP. It was the center of the flood relief operations in Browns Valley. And in recent months, public health has given the H1N1 vaccinations. So it's been a very big deal in all these communities, and I want you to know we appreciate that, and I want you to know how important it is. One other thing I wanted to mention, I work for a community action agency, and one of the other projects that we operate is the weatherization program, and as you're probably aware, that has grown significantly as a result of the ARRA money. And what happened is we had to hire some additional auditors to work on that program. When we advertised for that, we had over 100 applications. This is in Elbow Lake in Grant County, 100 applications. When we had last advertised 5-6 years ago, we received 5 or 6. The reason I mention this is that folks in the building trades just don't have work at this time. They don't have work, and when you're investing your money, it's good to look at things that help in many ways. And I want to thank you for your time and your consideration. And if I can answer any questions, I'd be glad to do that.
I think we'll take questions at the end now because we are starting to run on time. Mr. Cutts?
Madam Chair and committee members, I am Jerry Cutts. I'm the CEO of First Children's Finance. I am considering now changing my name. We've been involved with the bonding bill since 1991, at the point where it was expanded from Head Start to early care and education more broadly, and have had an opportunity over that time to witness a tremendous amount of productivity because of leaders like the people who testified today. The thing that's so important about that leadership in creating multiple services, integrating multiple services for family, is that they're able to leverage tremendous community resources. That's what people like these folks do at the local level. The leverage factor is really, really important. One little piece of history. First Children's Finance was created in 1991. The state has played a tremendous role in helping us provide business and financial services to early care and education businesses across the state, and we have leveraged those state funds many, many times over. As a matter of fact, due to the success of this program, the initial investment of the state, we're now working in 9 different states. The significance of that, the way that it relates to the bonding bill, is that one of the key components that makes this successful is technical assistance, and sometimes organizations are able to provide that themselves, the strategic business planning it takes to carry out these projects, and sometimes assistance is needed, whether the programs are in rural areas or whether they're in urban areas. And I would like to make kind of an offer and a challenge to the committee, which is with our own ability to package funds and leverage private resources, I'd like to offer that if the committee and ultimately the legislature and the governor are able to commit $5 million to this, that we will raise private funds to provide the technical assistance to all of the participants in the process with strategic business development and technical assistance through the course of the project. So I think I'm going to leave it with that.
Okay. Any questions? Now, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next project is going to be presented, I believe, by Senator Langsa on behalf of Senator Skoy.
Chair,
happy birthday, Senator Lang said.
It isn't for a week.
Happy birthday to you.
For a week. I may die between now and then.
Bye.
Oh, my gosh.
We have had the Children's Hospital in our bonding bill previously. It didn't succeed or go all the way. A number of you are quite familiar with it. It was a state-owned facility up until recent years. But I think mainly I'll turn it over to the people that could give you more details on it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Brewington. It does say Nick Riley on your agenda. He was called away to another meeting, so I will be speaking on behalf of Ramsey County. Gillette Hospital is both a Ramsey County and a statewide resource. In 2008, Gillette treated 3,253 patients living in Ramsey, and in 2008, Gillette treated 19,175 total patients from Minnesota. Over 50% of Gillette's patients are covered by Medicaid. This is approximately five times greater than the number of Medicaid patients treated at other Minnesota hospitals. Each year, Gillette sees patients from almost every single county in Minnesota. Typically, patients come from 86 out of the 87 Minnesota counties. Along with the Ramsey County facility, which is Gillette's main campus, Gillette also operates clinics in Burnsville, Duluth, Minnetonka, Maple Grove, and provides services to older teens and adults through Gillette's Lifetime Specialty Healthcare, also located in St. Paul. The Minnesota Legislature established Gillette in 1897. The legislature moved Gillette from its former location on Lake Phalen to its current location in 1977. The real estate and building space is now owned by Ramsey County. Gillette leases the space from Ramsey County. As the owner of the facility, Ramsey County is making the request for $20 million to design, construct, finish, and equip capital improvements to the facility. The total project is approximately $62 million. Groundbreaking took place in October of 2009. Gillette has raised $42 million to pay for the project. $20 million is needed from the legislature to complete the project. You all should have a copy of the resolution that was passed unanimously, a resolution supporting the project. I think that concludes my remarks.
So let's hold our questions till the end and take all the testimony first.
My name is James Hattigan. I am the Chief Financial Officer for Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. I will just go over a few points again that the Ramsey County representative did, and then we will also talk about the project itself. As you know, we were a state hospital up until about 20 years ago. Gillette has been serving kids with disabilities for over 100 years now. We've had a strong partnership with the state, both as a state institution and then in the 20 years since. You can look at this at your leisure. These handouts will show you some of the things that we do with the kids. We do outreach to all of the counties in the state. Handouts you see with the little trucks, those are actually real trucks that go out and serve kids in the rural communities. And I will point you to the last two pages of that handout, getting to the financial pieces. And the real question that I'm sure everyone has is, why would Gillette be asking for this money? Why would we need it? You've already heard that over 50% of the of our patients are covered by Medicaid, which is about five times the state average. Over the last 8 years, those rates have come down a great deal. We now sustain significant losses on that population of about $10 million a year. We're paid on average 61 cents for every dollar of cost of giving the care to these kids. And so when we do a project like this, it is difficult to do it entirely with private financing. We have raised some private financing for this project. But as you might imagine, that rating agencies are not, or are leery, of somebody with a high Medicaid population for the very reasons I just said, that they often don't pay costs. The project itself, as you can see, is a $62 million project with two phases. And you can see in the funding sources as well, what we're asking for the state for is $20 million to finish the project on the surgery particularly. We are attempting to increase our pediatric intensive bed unit. That's a crying need in St. Paul, both for our patients and also for patients that come through the Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center at the Regions, which is the only Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center in the state right now. And then we also have a crying need for enhanced surgery bays. Our children often have very, very complex cases requiring 8 to 10 hours of surgery, multiple surgeons. The rooms we have are rooms that we rented from Regions. They're older operating rooms, and not all of them are of the sufficient size to do the kind of cases that we need. And so then this expansion will both create more rooms, but also they will have the equipment and the size necessary to do these complex cases.
My name is Margaret Perryman. I'm the CEO at Gillette Children's Specialty Health Center. Senator Berglund, members of the committee, we appreciate very much your consideration, your positive consideration of this request. Our long association with the state is, I think, really very critical to our ability to provide the care that we've been able to provide. Gillette Children's, in addition to all the other statistics that we've shared with you, we were actually a state institution until 1989, and you know, continue in our partnership of providing health care services to the state's children who are disabled.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy is the chief author of the bill, but he wasn't able to be here, so I'm sitting in for him.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Makarios. I represent the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. And in addition to our members who are employed, I also represent today 1,400 out-of-work carpenters, lathers, floor coverers, pile drivers, and millwrights just in the Twin Cities. And thank you for just a quick minute to testify on this project. And in our opinion, the project at Gillette Children's is exactly the type of project that should be a top priority for state bonding this year. In addition to the fact that it's a worthy project on its own, this is also one worth $20 million in state tax dollars, and that's $62 million in construction work. That's exactly the kind of math that that we in the representing 26% of our members who are unemployed today, another 25% or so who are working 2 to 3 days a week whenever they can get work. We like that a lot. We sincerely appreciate that the legislature and Senator Vickerman in particular are putting a strong emphasis on projects that will create the most work for out-of-work construction workers. And we urge your consideration of this project. Thank you.
Are there any questions? I guess not. Thank you all very much. Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First time I've seen your committee administrator since the wedding. Married life is treating you well. Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing this bill. This is a request for bond proceeds for pre-design and design of a veterans nursing home in Hibbing. And just to give you a little background, back in the mid-90s when I was a member of the other body, some veterans from Hibbing had approached me and asked me if there was a possibility of building a veterans nursing home in Hibbing. And they had some pretty good reasons for it. There's two nursing homes on either side of Hibbing, one's in Silver Bay and one's in Fergus Falls. Both are over 90 minutes away. And they talked about how the distance to those locations, as well as the fact that when family has to go visit their loved ones in the nursing home, that it's quite a drive and it's quite difficult for them. So at the time, the local support was tepid at best, and there were two nursing homes in the town that both opposed the building of another nursing home. Well, since then, some things have changed, and one of them is that one of the nursing homes closed, and it wasn't due to lack of need. It was because of the fact that the building was in such bad shape that they couldn't keep the place open anymore and give the type of service that was worthy of people that were in the nursing home. Well, several other things have also happened. One is that it's 14 to 16 years have passed since we last looked at it. Our Vietnam vets are now in their 60s. And we're fighting wars on two fronts, and many of those people that are fighting are National Guardsmen who will be coming home from the war and maybe needing services. Also, in addition, St. Louis County has expressed a desire to be in line for a veterans nursing home as a result of a survey that they've just taken a look at, and Hibbing itself is in support. And so the survey that I'm referring to is a survey that was commissioned by the legislature itself. And what we did was we told the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the Minnesota Veterans Home to identify communities in the state that where it would be feasible to locate veterans homes. And so they went out and they got area veteran censuses, they got federal siting requirements, area demographics. They did a whole bunch of things to give us an indication of who might be eligible for veterans homes in this state. They came up with a list of about 17 different cities that might be eligible. And the characteristics that at least had to be met were they had to be at least 100 calculated minutes of calculated traveling time from an existing veterans home. They had to be within 60 minutes calculated travel time for residents of the and staff of an existing community-based outpatient clinic or a Veterans Administration medical center, and they had to have an acute care hospital licensed by the state of Minnesota. The study also said it provides the basis to entertain proposals from eligible communities to provide a site for a new Minnesota veterans home, and each community that offers a potential veterans home site is encouraged to communicate what unique characteristics they can offer to provide a home environment. We believe that Hibbing has not only has the demographics for a nursing home, but they also the geography of where Hibbing is located is very good for one of these nursing homes. And so what I brought here with me today are Commissioner of the St. Louis County, Steve Rocker, who's also the board chair, City Councilor Darby Sather. He's also a commander of the VFW in Hibbing, and County Veterans Service Officer Dan Domanicus, and they can give you a little bit more information. But we also have some handouts about the area itself, why Hibbing, and some pretty good information about the area. So, who wants to go first? Commissioner Rocker. Say your name
for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to be here. I've got a frog in my throat already. You know, as a county board chairperson, it's been interesting to sit here today and hear the smorgasbord of issues that you are faced with, and it's very remindful of the smorgasbord of issues that we face at the local level as well. County, St. Louis County in particular, being, a county of such large geographic area equal to the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island and a few other states. So we had at one point in time even thought about seeking statehood, but that issue just fell off the table. So anyway, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you. I know your time is of value, and as the senator pointed out, we have packets of information for you presented, and we'll be touching upon some of those. So we're very pleased that the city of Hibbing is one of the 17 communities of the state that has fulfilled all three of those minimum requirements, according to the study, to be further considered as a location for a new veterans nursing home. And I won't go over those details as the senator has pointed to what those are, those mandatory characteristics, those demographic and operational characteristics, and also those community asset issues that are very important, and I think you'll find in greater detail in the packets as you look through them. You know, with respect to the community assets, I think it's important to point out that those are the things that make a veteran's home a home for the veterans. And it's the site, it's the amenities in the community, the living area, facilities, and the campus environment, and all those things that this population that has served their country well is so richly deserving of. And we've identified those in great detail, I think, in the packets themselves. So at this time, I guess I'll call your attention to this particular handout here, the Veterans Home handout. It's a very colorful handout, and at the top of it, it's entitled Veterans Home in Hibbing, Minnesota. And it does identify in there all those mandatory characteristics, demographics, et cetera, that Hibbing has met through this preliminary phase of the process. But in addition, I think you can see in the handout that the Hibbing catchment area has the highest per capita concentration of veterans outside of the metro area. And those are the people that we need to serve. And it's the highest outside the metro area in the entire state. And that number is 48,000 veterans of all ages spread out over this 10-county catchment area, with St. Louis County alone hosting nearly half of those veterans. And next, I would ask you to take another look at the back of the handout, that being with the little map on there, and take a look at the statewide map. And as you can see, there are five existing veterans homes. I'm sure you're well familiar with that. In Minnesota, and they are nearly all concentrated in southern Minnesota, those being in Hastings, St. Paul, Luverne, and Fergus Falls. And the one VA nursing home in northern Minnesota is in Silver Bay. It is so isolated and difficult to get to that many people living in the Hibbing catchment area, in that 100-mile or 100-minute circle, simply they just don't go there. And these circles, as you can see, clearly make that point. I would also point to in the handout there's an example, I think, that bears out that point with respect to accessibility, and it's a little personal story about a resident, and it's in the third paragraph on the front page, and rather than take up your time to read that, I certainly would have encouraged you to do so, because it is a personal story about an individual who was placed in the Silver Bay home, and the elderly wife traveled to that location years on end until such time she herself could no longer make the journey. And rather than to really abandon her husband in that nursing home facility and relieve herself of the role of his playing in her husband's care, she chose to have her husband pulled out of that facility and put into a private nursing home in the Hibbing community. And you know, that's not all entirely bad. The private nursing homes do have facilities, but they are not the same as veterans nursing home facilities in many respects, and I think you probably all know that. So for that reason, you know, as I pointed out, the only two counties of the 10 in the Arrowhead are being served by that facility, and for a whole host of reasons, the rest of those veterans serving in the other 8 counties remain very much underserved throughout that northern part of the state of Minnesota. And I would also encourage you to look again at that backside of the handout and focus on that huge void that I'm trying to illustrate, representing those circles there, the green circles with the cities of Hibbing and Bemidji, the focus of those two catchment areas. And it runs across the entire northern one-third of the state. And those green circles, I think, clearly demonstrate that both Hibbing and Bemidji have in place the critical infrastructure to host a veterans nursing home should the state make a decision to move forward one. And with limited dollars that we're dealing with this today, obviously things should be data-driven, and I think the statistics and data clearly point to the merits of having a veterans nursing home to serve those populations and to fill that void that is very evident. Both those cities, I guess, Hibbing and Bemidji, if you also notice, barely touch or overlap any of the other orange-red concentric circles that depict the catchment areas of the existing veterans home. And I think that's important to point out because everywhere else in Minnesota and all those other five locations, there's overlap and duplication. And that should ring well when you're trying to divide dollars up and try to serve the entire state. So, and I would remind you again that the North Shore catchment, or the red-orange circle, with the center of that being Silver Bay, is not serving the balance of the state and that area to the north and to the northwest. And if you look at that circle clearly, a little bit of levity, well over half of it is in Lake Superior. So unless they're serving the folks that are riding on the ore carriers up to Thunder Bay, they're simply not getting served. And following, I guess we believe that common sense should tell us that when you combine the large concentration of vets that live in northern Minnesota, one-third of the state not having service, and the Iron Range in all the northernmost counties, and you overlay that over the veterans population that we have over that huge void, it seems to be very clear that Hibbing is either the best site in the state or at least one of two best sites for the next veterans nursing home in Minnesota. So on that note, I guess I'm going to turn to Rich Damankis, the Chief Veterans Service Officer for St. Louis County, who I hope will talk about the challenges of delivering services to that population over a large geographic area. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Like Commissioner Rocker says, my name is Rich Damankis. I'm the Director of St. Louis County Veterans Service Office. We have four offices up there. St. Louis County, it's approximately 7,000 square miles. So it's a fairly large county. But with just that county and the surrounding counties in this catchment area, if you look on the front page of it, there's roughly 48,000 veterans in those areas. And I hope that you do consider funding Senator Tomasoni's bill appropriating money for a nursing home in Hibbing, because working up there, veterans in the north, I believe, sometimes are not served as well as the southern portion of Minnesota. And I don't mean to whine about it or anything like that, but when I look at it, we have multiple Minnesota National Guard units up there. We have the 114th Transportation Company, who's currently in Afghanistan right now. We have the 148th Fighter Wing. They've been to Iraq three times already. And right now they're serving in Afghanistan. And today's current events, we're creating veterans every single day. Back in the 90s, we were relying on active duty for a lot of to step up and serve on active duty. Now we're relying on the citizen soldiers back here in Minnesota. In the northern portion, we're gaining a bigger population of veterans up in the north. And as you can see on that map, it is pretty bare up in there for veterans' benefits. And one of the things that I disagree with is some people say, well, if you want those benefits, you should move to where the benefits are. Well, I disagree with that, because we have veterans up there who served and they went back to their communities, the communities that they love, the families that they wanted to live by. And yeah, that's their choice, but that's an area that they love and they grew up in. And they come back and they get employed up there and they become productive citizens. But I realize that not all those veterans are going to use a nursing home or a Minnesota veterans home. But when you look at the travel distance between Hibbing and Silver Bay, if you look on the map, there's not a major road in between to take to transport the veteran or the families of the veterans to Silver Bay. Yes, there is. And I also like to point out that a veteran and their family living in Black Duck, Minnesota, would rather drive 99 miles to Hibbing rather than 153 miles to Fergus Falls. Or a veteran living in Baudette, Minnesota, they would rather drive the 165 miles to Hibbing rather than 233 miles to the closest one, which would be Fergus Falls, or 248 miles to Silver Bay. I mean, and Silver Bay is a great home, don't get me wrong. But when I talk to veterans and their families, and I talk to them about going into a Minnesota veterans home, and we talk about Silver Bay, they give me a look because they worry about driving that distance, especially in the wintertime. The road going to Silver Bay is sometimes hazardous, and it's treacherous. And when I talk to the families, they worry about taking the veteran up to Silver Bay, and they worry about leaving the veteran alone and the veteran feeling that they're abandoned. And again, please don't think that Silver Bay Silver Bay is a great nursing home. I visit there all the time with the VFW and the American Legions, and even with my job, I visit all the time, and I'm very happy with Silver Bay. But I'd like to see a nursing home that's ran by the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs placed in Hibbing because of the demographics. We have a lot of veterans just in Hibbing alone. In the Iron Range, we have over, in that area of the Iron Range, we have over 14,000 Vietnam veterans, just Vietnam veterans, not ones that served in Korea and Vietnam or World War II, Vietnam and Korea or the Gulf War, but we have Vietnam veterans, just 14,000 of them up in that area that are coming down with conditions, as you all are aware, that Parkinson's and leukemia and ischemic heart disease are now presumptive to exposure of Agent Orange. And these veterans are coming down with those diseases and those illnesses. And eventually, very soon, probably the majority of them will need to be put into a nursing home, sadly to say. And if we could build one in Hibbing, the families would be able to travel a closer distance to visit their veteran or the mother or the father, the spouse of the veteran who was placed in the nursing home also. And Hibbing, of course, we have the CBOC up there, the community-based outpatient clinic, that's like 2 minutes away from Hibbing. I mean, it's in Hibbing, so where we place the nursing home, it would be less than 2 minutes away. But we also have Fairview Memorial Hospital up there, or University Medical Center. They are known as the only level 3 trauma center on the Iron Range who could also assist the nursing home. And what really caught my eye about Fairview is they offer a transportation system in the local community. They pick up from the door to the hospital. So in other words, when I talked to Mr. Bymark up there in Fairview, he said that they would be willing, if the care was needed, to pick up veterans from the nursing home in Hibbing and transport them to the Fairview University Medical Center. And they also transport to the Twin Cities. So if a veteran had to come down here for specialty care, they would provide transportation. And it's an ambulatory, it's a non-emergency transportation system, so they have qualified drivers who could handle patients that need ambulatory services.
We do need to move along.
Okay. And I just, Madam Chair, members of the committee, please, again, I ask you to consider Senator Tomasoni's bill for the veterans that are residing in Hibbing and the whole Iron Range. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, lastly, we have with us Darby Sater, City Councilor and Commander of VFW Post 85.
Senator Rickman, committee, thank you from 48, close to 50,000 veterans up in northern Minnesota and the whole state for what you have done for the benefits for veterans over the past years. Came here as twofold. Number one, I'm on the City Council of Hibbing, which will go out of our way, whatever it takes. And as you heard the three people in front of me, I come up as the fourth batter to clean up hitter. I don't have to do much because they all hit nice home runs, and so I'll move on. Like you say, you heard a lot of data there and got a lot of it in front of you. Being a Vietnam veteran, combat corpsman with Marine Corps in Vietnam, many of us, when we do come back, when we take off our military clothing, we move into the community, and as a veteran, we're number one in war, and out of war, we try to be number one in the community. We have little over 100 different posts, American Legions, Veterans Foreign Wars, disabled veterans, etc., that are anxious to work with our brothers and sisters from the, you know, the cliffs of Normandy to the steaming hot jungles of Vietnam, and we're all bonded together from the cold winters in Korea to the 100-degree plus deserts in Iraq. As presently these veteran groups, we do much for the community, from children to senior citizens. Myself being part of the honor guard, we have quarterly, we go to our nursing home there and put on a patriotic program for the veterans and the whole nursing home, which is one of the better turnouts that the nursing home says they have, because it's a lot of fun, it's a lot of camaraderie, a lot of cake and ice cream, and when we see some of the veterans get up on their walker and salute when we come by with the flag as their entrance and go and talk to them, and they hold their hand after we present them maybe with a robe that says USA on it, and they, you know, they got little tears in their eyes. They got a good feeling about themselves. And this is what we're all about, and this is what we'll do for this veterans' homecoming to Hibbing, because we care. We care for the veteran.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I have just one question, and that is every veterans nursing home bed that gets added in the state adds cost to the operating budget of this division. And we're going the other direction. We're not increasing funding. We're going the other direction. So if we were to add another nursing home, be it in Hibbing or any other part of Minnesota, how do we cover those operating costs without having to take it away from some other part of our budget?
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, thanks. And thank you to the gentleman here that testified. I appreciate your service. And nobody
Senator
works.
Coring, I didn't get my question answered.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I thought maybe you were going to follow up on that.
Well, I have a question that's similar to that.
Let's see if we can get the first one answered here.
Oh, Madam Chair, I guess we have all kinds of budget problems around the state, and I don't know that we have any answers to any of the budget problems that we have, whether it be education or health and human services or veterans or what it might be. And I think somewhere along the way, we've got to figure out that government services are actually valuable services to the state of Minnesota as well as to the people of this country, and that we need to fund it where it's necessary to be funded. And at this point in time, I realize we got problems, but I happen to have a solution you might like, but I'll bring that up to you another time.
So the only solution you would suggest would be new revenue?
Well, Madam Chair, I think at $1.2 billion between now and June 30th and looking at another $6 billion in the next biennium, I don't think the only solution is new revenue, because I don't think we can raise enough new revenue based on some of the things that I've seen. So I don't know what the answer is, but hopefully the economy recovers and hopefully we have a big bonding bill this year so that we can put some people back to work and we generate some revenue through people working. And the health of this state has to definitely be first and foremost in our mind, and there will be cuts, but I think there also needs to be jobs created and needs to be revenue raised also.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, back to you gentlemen. Thanks for your service, and thanks for coming all the way down here. And nobody serves his constituents better than Senator Tomasoni, but I want to point out a couple of things. The study that you referred to, the department itself actually ranked where they think that a veterans nursing home needs to be. And the first spot is Little Falls, the second spot is Brainerd, and the third spot is Crosby, or that are all in my district. And the people in my district are all excited about it and want a veterans nursing home too. But I gave them a little dose of reality, and it's my understanding somebody has told them that the local match or the local portion is $9 million. Now, the county of Morrison County has $5 million worth of debt. That would be doubling their debt. And I said, can you afford to put that on your citizens? And they said, I don't think we can. Brainerd is 100 miles away from Fergus Falls, so we're 100 miles away from a veterans nursing home and 150 miles away from Minneapolis. So you're not in any different situation than I am. And so the addition that we're right in the process of putting on to Fergus Falls, and Senator Berglund knows this, is going to add $900,000, and you talked to Commissioner Hansen about this, $900,000 in operating costs that we have to come up with.
No, we don't.
We don't?
We never approved one of those beds.
But
people who build beds figure out how to pay for them,
right.
And we didn't build them.
But that's still going to come up, where that request is going to probably be a supplemental request from the administration, I'm guessing. So this is a tough deal, and it goes back. Let me just give me one more minute. I think the way that we're going at things is the wrong way, where I have two nursing homes in Brainerd. I have one in Little Falls. I have one in Piers. I have one in Pine River. I have one in Crosby. Why don't we have a veterans wing or a veterans portion dedicated with the veterans beds, whether it's 10 or 15 beds or 20 beds or 5 beds in each location? And then the family doesn't have to go very far. Their loved one is right there, and the infrastructure's already there. The kitchen's there. The staff is there. It makes more sense. Rather than, even if we have a veterans nursing home in Brainerd, in Hibbing, somebody's still going to be a long ways away from their loved one. And right now, we already have the infrastructure right there. Why not try to figure out something that works along that line? I just think that that's...
Chair, Senator Coring, I think I gave you that idea a while back.
No, but I don't think
yeah,
so.
I think so.
If I might, Madam Chair, and Senator Coring, I don't think we would be adverse to that whole concept. We do have a lot of buildings that might be suitable for this. We have nursing homes. We have a nursing home close in our community that has taken those beds out of our community, and our citizens are finding themselves driving further to get to the care. So there are facilities that could be added to and or accommodated. I think the issue we speak to is there's the large population and growing population of veterans that are underserved. It seems to be more obvious perhaps in our area, it's not uncommon that the northern third of the state seems to get ignored on a lot of different issues and a lot of different fronts. So we wish Brainerd in your area very well, and I hope that you could get a nursing home, a veterans nursing home there, because that would certainly serve us better than having to go to Silver Bay or to Fergus Falls. But that still doesn't address the entire issue of over 48,000 underserved veterans in the catchment area that we identified. So, but we could probably work as a team and accomplish this.
Well, we probably should have also been a little more careful when the Iron Range insisted on having one. At Silver Bay, probably could have made a better decision.
But that wasn't during my time.
I didn't say it was. I'm just reminding people that sometimes we should be careful what we wish for. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also am very familiar with the veterans nursing home issue. And actually, in my district, the southern end of it butts up to Senator Coring's district. There are people in my district who would find the Brainerd location the most convenient for them. There's also a large effort in Bemidji, as I'm sure you're aware, to bring a nursing home there. And when you look at the map, depending on which factors you're considering, you know, so many of us who live in northern Minnesota kind of chuckle about the fact that people talk about St. Cloud or even Brainerd as being up north. When you look at Brainerd, it's actually right in the middle of the state. And
is that how Fergus Falls got in the south?
Fergus Falls is actually in the middle of the state, too. It's just farther west in the middle of the state. But there is a whole area in the northwest corner of the state that isn't even on this map because, you know, there isn't anything in anybody's catchment area that even exists there. And so, and also, as I'm sure you know, the tribes are very much disproportionately represented in terms of the number of people who have served and the number of people who are now veterans, and the three largest tribes, White Earth, Red Lake, Leech Lake, have all been very working on the Bemidji location because they have a lot of people living in the community of Bemidji who, and it's also, you know, convenient for them in terms of a place to get to. But I think we're always not well served when there's a better solution, as Senator Coring suggested, that might serve everyone's needs rather than putting any veterans at odds with each other, which we certainly don't want to be. And so to Senator Berglund's question, what I wondered, you know, there was a lot of testimony at the meetings they've had in Bemidji about people who live in the tribe saying they simply don't go to because St. Cloud is too far away or other places they might go to are too far away. And so they're relying on services that are also expensive services that have to be provided where they live. So when we're looking at the cost of beds, I wonder if there's any offset for those other costs that we wouldn't have to be paying if they were able to be served, and if we should be doing that, you know, to see.
There isn't any offset.
But in our budget, shouldn't we be offsetting that if we're having to pay one way for something, or is it always assumed that it's going to be more expensive?
The eligibility for veterans to receive assistance from the Veterans Administration is much higher than Medicaid, so there isn't an offset. Many times if they're in another nursing home, they're a private pay.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess the impression I had is that these aren't people who are in another nursing home. They're people being cared for by their families and accessing local other kinds of services. So I'm just wondering if...
Most of the time, if they are, they're private pay.
Okay.
Other questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I want to just reiterate one thing that I said earlier, and it's... In reference to the survey that the legislature actually asked the Department of Veteran Affairs to do. And the study provides the basis to entertain proposals from eligible communities to provide a site for a new Minnesota veterans home. Each community that offers a potential veterans home site is encouraged to communicate what unique characteristics they can offer to provide a home environment. And it basically...
Senator, I'm not suggesting you're not serving your community well by bringing this proposal. I am just trying to point out to you and the members of my division that it would carry operating costs with it that we don't have right now.
I wanted to point out that I'm sensitive to that. I wanted to point out the reason that we're here is because of that particular thing in the survey indicating that they would like to see people offer.
I understand, and I certainly think everybody should have an opportunity to make a case for their community besides Wilmer, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Actually, I don't know if you saw the study, but Brainerd is number two. Okay. The only thing is I don't really know all of my constituents all in one. We have to pay for the operating costs in this division. She's going to ask me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This proposal is a proposal that comes from Hennepin County, and it is to help them construct a new hyperbaric oxygen chamber. They have the only one in the state, serves people from all over the region, and it's a very old facility. It's not actually located in the hospital itself, and so it's not very efficient in terms of the staffing that has to happen for this facility. And it breaks down quite frequently now because of its age. And so there is a need to replace it, and that is what the request is. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Atkinson to talk a little more about the people that receive care through this facility.
Dr. Atkinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I think I just would like to do a few introductory remarks and then hand it over to Dr. Atkinson.
Okay. Mr. Godfrey, welcome back to the Senate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name, for the record, is David Godfrey. I'm the Public Policy Manager at Hennepin County Medical Center. And I just wanted to mention that this is a $5 million bonding request. The total project cost $9.7 million. The local match of $4.7 million, we would pay finance through existing capital that's already been earmarked or set aside at the hospital, and then also provide funding through philanthropic efforts through our newly created Hennepin Health Foundation. And I think what we'd like to do next is just show a video, and the video explains a bit about hyperbaric medicine, tells a little bit about the history of our program, and shows some of the challenges we face with the existing facility.
Okay. Somebody gonna turn it on.
Oh, Shannon,
do it. Members, Director.
HCMC Hyperbaric Medicine is physically located at the corner of 5th Street and Portland Avenue, 2 blocks from the hospital and 3 blocks from the emergency department. We've been providing service for 45 years to the state of Minnesota. The current facility was built in 1963 and has undergone no significant renovations since then. It is the last standing vestige of the old General Hospital. Space at the current facility is inadequate for the current volume of activity and limits growth potential and its compromising patient privacy. We have only one exam cubicle, 2 small bathrooms that serve as locker rooms for 12 to 24 patients daily, and 1 small intake assessment area. The small waiting room is just inside the front door, a throughfare that renders cold winter air to those waiting. The chamber itself can accommodate more patients, but the space around the chamber is too small to provide standard patient care services. Scheduled patients with chronic conditions comprise the majority of patients receiving hyperbaric oxygen, each patient having 30 to 40 treatments, 1 per day, Monday through Friday. Hyperbaric oxygen is a specialized medical treatment in which the patient receives 100% oxygen while inside a chamber at increased atmospheric pressure. Emergency patients come to HCMC for hyperbaric from all over Minnesota, adjacent states, and Canada. Hyperbaric oxygen is used for specific medical conditions and has long been recognized as vital in the resolution of critical medical conditions such as gas gangrene, carbon monoxide poisoning, trauma and surgical procedures, and decompression sickness. The current off-campus location of the facility presents serious safety issues and limits hours of operation. Stable hospitalized patients must travel by wheelchair or cart through public, non-hospital hallways and go outside for 30 feet to enter or leave the hyperbaric facility. Critically ill and emergency patients must be transported by ambulance from the ICUs in the emergency department to the hyperbaric chamber. The hyperbaric facility, despite being an extension of the inpatient hospital service, has no ready access to the code team, radiology, laboratory, or security, which impacts the efficiency of care for critical patients and safety for our staff. The equipment is at the end of its expected life and needs to be replaced. Recently, the facility has experienced frequent escalating mechanical problems. Here you see significant rust accumulation in our pipes. Waiting for several years for a new facility is not feasible, as the repairs are major and could cause the service to shut down. St. Luke's Hospital in Milwaukee also has a long-established history of hyperbaric medicine and also has a chamber of similar vintage to ours. Their chamber is currently being replaced with a new Finck multiplace, somewhat larger than the one we are requesting. Mayo opened their chamber and program last year, but are not providing emergency or critical service. Despite the addition of Mayo, HCMC continues to grow and receive referrals from northern and central Minnesota, North Dakota, and western Wisconsin. Hyperbaric for emergency patients is a signature component of the critical care program and the only Minnesota hospital offering this service. Without this service, these patients would need to be transferred to Milwaukee or Iowa City. Hyperbaric medicine supports the mission of HCMC to be the hospital where any person or any illness and injury can be treated at any time. Approximately 100 emergency patients are referred to HCMC annually for life, limb-threatening infections, carbon monoxide poisoning, air gas embolism, and decompression sickness.
That concludes the video. Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, before I turn it over to Dr. Atkinson, I would just mention that I forgot to mention that this has been identified by the Hennepin County Board as its top bonding priority for this year. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Cheryl Atkinson.
Dr. Atkinson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cheryl Atkinson, and I appreciate the chance to come emphasize just 2 points about our proposal that I would like you to take into consideration as you review it in detail. The first point is that the hyperbaric chamber at Hennepin County Hospital is a resource for all of Minnesota, not just for poor people and not just for people who live in Hennepin County. Chances are good that someone from your district was treated for emergency care at the hyperbaric chamber in the last 18 months. I say this because 59% of those counties sent us one emergency patient at least in the last 18 months. There's a map in your handout that details which counties those were. As you learned from the video, we do regular daily treatments. I'm not going to emphasize those because, in fact, hyperbaric treatments on emergency basis are those that are life-saving and those that need to be done immediately and those that can only be done at Hennepin right now. You know that from 1963 to 2008, we were the only hyperbaric chamber in the state, and that was made available to all of Minnesota. In 2008, Mayo Clinic put in a state-of-the-art multi-place facility, and in 2009, Abbott Northwestern put in a small facility. The problem is Mayo has no intention of taking emergency patients from all over the state, and Abbott Northwestern is not set up to do any emergency care, and as far as we know, plans none. So HCMC remains the only place for Minnesotans to get emergency hyperbaric care whenever they need it, no matter how sick they are. I believe this is important to all Minnesotans, because if they can't get it at Hennepin, they need to go to Iowa City or Milwaukee for this care. And transport is a detrimental thing for people in an emergency situation because it delays care and decreases the effectiveness of treatment for these indications. You might be saying to yourself, well, if Hennepin weren't doing it, then one of these other hospitals would, or another hospital would step up. We've got a lot of very good hospitals in Minnesota. What you need to understand is that there's no competition for these patients. Hospitals compete all the time for some patients. They're not competing for these patients. And there are two very good reasons why they're not competing. Number one is that they're very expensive. To provide a specialty service 24/7 with a relatively low volume use is not cost effective. It requires a specialty crew of doctors, nurses, and technicians. It requires a facility that's designed, equipped, and stocked to manage to deliver intensive care 24/7. And that doesn't end up being productive for the bottom line. In addition, the hospital that this chamber is located in has to be prepared also to take the sickest of the sick. And that means an ED that's staffed 24/7 with experts in critical care of trauma and medical illness. It means surgeons available, eager, and able to take a patient directly from the ER with a soft tissue infection that's life-threatening to the OR, and then allow them to go over to the hyperbaric chamber, and then keep doing that back and forth for the next 24 hours to try and save their lives. It requires intensive care specialists who are accustomed to treating multi-system failure, not just kidney failure or heart failure or brain failure, but all three in the same patient, and they have to be there and ready whenever that patient arrives. What I just described to you is not any hospital in Minnesota. It's not a community hospital. It's not a regional hospital. It's a hospital like Hennepin that has residency programs, that has staff present in all major specialties all the time, practicing state-of-the-art in that specialty. And I would say, in addition, it requires a hospital with an ethic of service. And I think Hennepin has been outstanding in that regard since its inception as the General Hospital in Minneapolis. To put a little bit more visual for you, who are these emergency patients? A lot of them are carbon monoxide poison patients, and as many of you know, carbon monoxide is the most frequent poisoning in the U.S. and the most frequent cause of poisoning death in the U.S. There are 100,000 very serious poisonings in the United States a year. We treat 100 serious CO patients in the chamber every year on average. More patients are affected by CO in rural areas than in the Twin Cities, which is a statistic that surprised me. But we don't pay a lot of attention to where our patients are coming from all the time. Accidental poisonings are more common in Minnesota. They make up the vast majority of CO poison patients. The legislature has done an excellent job of preventative health care for carbon monoxide poisoning by mandating CO detectors in homes. And that has saved numerous lives throughout the years. But people still get poisoned with carbon monoxide. For example, in the last weekend in November, when the weather turned cold, we treated 11 patients for carbon monoxide poisoning. Seven patients were in one family, aged 2 to 32, and four other patients came from four other households. That same weekend, we treated another patient with one of our other next most common problems, and that's that life-threatening soft tissue infection that was mentioned on the video. Patients with this kind of infection have a very high mortality, and even those who survive oftentimes lose a limb or lose major chunks of tissue from their chest or abdomen. Another emergency that we treat numerous times a year is air embolism or gas embolism to the brain. What's involved there is air gets into the bloodstream of the brain, causing obstruction of blood flow and resulting in immediate neurologic injury. That can be manifested as continuous seizures or as unconsciousness or as a stroke-like symptom. When those patients are treated promptly, oftentimes they recover completely. If they're not treated, they may not recover any of that function. We've provided for you a single sheet of paper in your handouts with 8 case reports from last year, just to give you an overview. Included in those is a 47-year-old woman from Cosmos, Minnesota, with CO poisoning, who was unconscious on a ventilator when she arrived at Hennepin, made a full recovery, and is now at home with her family. Another in that series is a 40-year-old man from Faribault, Minnesota, who had a spontaneous infection in his groin and thigh and buttock, which threatened not only his life but his leg. He also recovered with intensive treatment and kept his leg. In addition, we treated a 10-year-old boy from the Twin Cities who was taking scuba diving lessons in a pool at the University of Minnesota. Perfectly healthy boy who developed air embolism. His symptoms were an unbearable headache and inability to walk. That boy was referred to us very promptly, treated, and made a complete recovery. You may find some of the other cases of interest also. Now I'd like to move to the second point. That is that there is an urgent need for funds to replace the hyperbaric facility at Hennepin. You heard a bit about it. The chamber, the building, all the infrastructure was built in 1963. It has required little maintenance during that time, and it has not been updated at all. This has been on the agenda for Hennepin County for many years, but it came to get serious attention in 2007, 2008, when we had multiple failures in multiple systems that threatened to close down the facility and threatened the welfare of our patients being treated. HCMC put high priority on replacing this chamber and allocated $9.7 million to replace the chamber at a new location on the HCMC campus. The life expectancy of a new chamber is 50 years, so we wouldn't be back next year asking for more money. Things seem to be moving along well until the economy dropped out and the governor's unallotment resulted in freezing of all capital expenditures at the hospital. Over the past year and a half, the hospital has used emergency capital funds up to $750,000 to make those repairs and replacements at the chamber that we thought would give us 1 to 2 more years of functional service. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. One of those 1 to 2 years is already gone, and it takes 18 months from the time we contract for the chamber to the time we can use it. So a year and a half from now, if we had the money now, we could open the doors to our new unit. In the meantime, the clock keeps ticking on this old and tired facility. The ever-present threat is some system, some unit will fail that can't be replaced or repaired. That's the day we'll cease to serve the citizens of Minnesota. So that's why we're here asking for money today. We need it soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Atkinson. Are there any questions from the committee? I have two that I hope are short and quick. The one is, I'm interested to know where you are in the planning process and the design process of this, meaning how soon can you start construction on this facility? And secondly, you made reference to the Mayo Clinic, and of course, it's probably not surprising that that caught my interest. And so I'm wondering if HCMC has had any conversations, or to what degree conversations have taken place between that institution and your institution with regard to the need that you've identified for the state of Minnesota.
We have
Dr. Atkinson.
Madam Chairman. We have had contact with Mayo because we helped them design and set up and train their staff. So we're friends with the people who run the chamber at Mayo. We have not discussed this particular issue except to call them when our chamber was broken down and ask them if we could refer emergency patients there, and they said no. The other problem with Mayo doing what we're doing now is they're down at the extreme edge of our state. We're up here in the major population center, and not only are they saying they don't intend to treat these patients, but patients from northern Minnesota would have to go all the way down there to get treatment. With respect to your first question, how ready are we? We are, at one point we were telling the board we're shovel ready. We have the plans for the chamber down to the umpteenth detail that we worked out for a couple of years. We have the space determined in the hospital and preliminary plans of that. We could order the chamber tomorrow, which is the rate limiting step on putting it in.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Atkinson, so you're saying that if there is an emergency that gets flown to Mayo, they have to fly that person up to the HCMC? They won't accept an emergency case? Because to me, it seems like hyperbaric is an emergency continually. I mean, when it happens, under the definition that you just explained, that's an emergency.
That is an emergency.
Dr. Atkinson.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chairman, Senator, I'll get this. For emergency indications, hyperbaric oxygen treatment is an emergency. I think what would happen instead is the patient would not be flown to Mayo. They would be flown here. If we didn't have a facility, again, we would not accept that patient. We would arrange for Iowa City or Milwaukee to accept that patient, and hopefully they could fly directly there. They would probably have to come to our airport to get a fixed wing to do that, but they wouldn't have to come to our hospital. Does that answer your question? Mayo Clinic will be busy, as any other hyperbaric facility is busy, treating stable, chronic problems. And I am sure that if they are treating somebody and they have a problem that needs emergency treatment, that they may do that. I can't speak for them any more than that.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Because I'm trying to make the definition between the emergency definition here. And also myself and these other two, well, all of us sit on the bonding committee, actually. And in the regional significance that we place the definition on bonding projects, And I remember the first year I was up in the north area, and the hospital up there got a helicopter pad paid by the state. And I thought, and I'm in deep rural Minnesota. And I just thought, my God, you know, this, we don't ask for things like that where we come from. Our facilities just go ahead and pay for this. So I'm very glad to see there is a matching dollar amount in this. And I'm trying to distinguish that this is definitely something that the entire state can use, even though I noticed that most of the area that you did not serve is my Senate district. So I just want to make sure that this is something that the state absolutely has to have, because the other facilities are not filling that need.
Okay. I would say that that is true. But other facilities in the state are not serving the need. And it might be that you don't have anybody, that you just didn't happen to have anybody that had an emergency in the time frame they were charting this. But I'm sure there has been people from your community that have used this facility.
I'll just conclude by saying that I think I have an opportunity that's been presented to me to follow up with my institution and see what types of services they are, in fact, offering. Senator Berglund, any concluding remarks? Okay. Thank you. And at this time,
Senator Wieger.
Oh, thank you.
Senator Wieger, you've been very patient. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We have a proposal that seeks $2 million. Not only is it regionally significant, it's state significant and could be the best project that we could show throughout the country. It's ready to go. There's collaboration, and it will reduce operating efficiency dollars at the agency. You are all aware of the impact of domestic violence in our state. It costs lives. It causes emotional scarring for thousands of Minnesotans. And one of the major providers of services for domestic violence is Tubman, formerly Tubman Family Alliance. This proposal, members, would seek $2 million to help renovate a building purchased by Tubman in Maplewood, and that's at near the Hill Murray High School at Larpinder and Highway 120. The fiscal agent would be the city of Maplewood. To expand on the vision, the dream, and most importantly, the hope for those people that would receive those services, I will ask the president, executive director of Tubman, Bev Dusso, to address you. And we did have several others that are here to provide support, but in recognition of your time, we'll focus comments through President Dusso.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, and members of the Budget Division. I just want to say I recognize that I'll leave much of this out, realizing how much you know about the need for chemical and mental health support services, which are part of the agency and for which I know, Senator Berglund, you've worked for many, many, many years, and we thank you. Together with me today, although not testifying due to the lateness of the hour, I have board members here, both from the Building Committee and our Treasury Audit Committee, Bob Erickson, some of you may know formerly from the University of Minnesota, and the Assistant City Manager, Chuck All, who is here from Maplewood so that we can demonstrate his support, and Maplewood's City Attorney, Alan Cantrude. I know my own name, Bev Dusso, but it's late, forgive me. I'm here to speak to and I'll stay on the script because I know you're very tired and we can't do head, shoulders, knees, and toes at this hour. I'm here to speak to the City of Maplewood's $2 million bonding proposal for a regional multi-service center. Over 35 years of work in family violence, youth programming, and community mental health has led us today to two key findings. First, when people present themselves in crisis at our facilities, They face multiple barriers, not just one. Domestic violence, legal problems, parenting, traumatized youth, mental health concerns, chemical dependency, and many more, as you well know. The second primary finding for our years of expertise is that collaborations are the most effective way to bringing into existence these results, not siloed agencies that are overly specialized. Having a platform from which people can work together across these disciplines will reduce the barriers and bring about lasting change faster. This request responds to both of these findings and will provide multiple space for multiple challenges that can be addressed and effectively and in a focused way resolved. The project will save money not only for Tubman but the state, both in short and long terms. We anticipate operational savings up to about $200,000 annually as a result of consolidating our two east shelters under one roof. The other savings will occur simply as a result of staff and key partnerships being co-located. Because we anticipate state funding to be flat, we need these cost savings to help us offset a nearly 50% increase in all of our major programs since June of this year. It's staggering. The entire project is grounded in fiscal responsibility, I assure you. The building, formerly St. Paul's Monastery, was purchased by Tubman at a fraction of its real value, thanks to the sisters, as I'm sure you can imagine. Making necessary safety and security improvements will assure use of a 100,000 square foot facility. Maintaining a regional multi-service center will vastly increase access to our broad array of services and those of the partners we anticipate will be in the building with us. This, in turn, will allow community members to overcome their barriers more quickly. Tubman's first goal is access to services. This is because we're committed to crisis prevention, not just intervention. And we know that this speedy intervention reduces public safety dollars, health dollars, police time, and frankly, it just saves lives. Scope of the project reaches far beyond our Maplewood city limits. Tubman has always served the entire East Metro area, but this center will also house a nationally significant learning institute, as well as provide like agencies with key findings and best practices in our areas of expertise. Tubman has always valued innovation, learning, and change. This proposal will create the springboard from which we can increase research, learning, and collaboration as never before. Additionally, it will allow Tubman to leverage existing community partnerships and create a new collaborative inroads, both in the private and public sector. I'll just give you a couple of examples of this. The agency currently works with 18 East Metro law enforcement agencies, several of whom may have offices within the facility. As a nonprofit, we understand the need to leverage volunteers and partnerships and structure projects to include and change systems and academic engagement as well. This space, a hub of our service, will not only be a place for 200-plus pro bono attorneys and more than 200 interns from over 50 colleges and universities, plus, of course, 500 volunteers. Bottom line, we hope you see the value in the proposal and that it will indeed enhance and help the quality of living for Minnesotans, and indeed the state's health and human service bottom line. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for listening to this. We certainly can answer questions if you wish, but I understand that it is very late.
Are there questions? We thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we have these sheets to fill out to help us rank our priorities for Senator Langseth's committee, and you should rank them 1 through 7, with 1 being your top priority and 2 being your second priority, etc. And then we will collect them today, and we will send our letter off to Senator Langseth tomorrow. Well, we're not in. in session, so we can't let you take them home and fill them out over the weekend. Mayor Lynch?
Madam Chair, I'm just noticing that there are a number of members that aren't in the room at the moment, and I understand the deadline.
Well, some of them did fill them out just before they left. Not everyone did, but, you know, we've been told we have to do this now. We can't wait till we're in session, so we'll be too late.
Duly noted.
Remind the committee that they need to be here.
I did say something when people started walking out. Didn't I say something?
Right, yeah. Remind the committee that they need to be here. Those who show up are the ones that get things done.
Exactly.
Are you giving me your vote?
I'm here.
We've got them all.
No. Proxy, that's in Washington. You can get by proxy.
So that concludes our meeting. Thank you very much for your good attendance. I really appreciate it. The meeting's adjourned.
We got to start by our name.
So that's it.